You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of April 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, a Russian helicopter comes down in Syria some weeks after Russia claimed to have withdrawn. So what is Russia still doing there? My guests Michael Goldfarb and Matthew Green will be discussing that and the day's other big stories, including...
Look, I got the Trump action figure!
What does he do?
He pretends to be a Republican!
Donald Trump's unarguable achievement in job creation. We'll be asking why over half the money spent on attack ads in the US election so far is being thrown at one target. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to today's edition of Midori House. My guests today are Michael Goldfarb, journalist and author, most recently of Emancipation, and Matthew Green, also journalist and author, currently of Aftershock. Welcome both. We will start tonight with Syria, which has recently been the source of some very tentatively and extremely relatively good news stories. Territorial reversals for Islamic State, an official end to Russia's debatably effective but certainly heavy-handed intervention. However, as today's fatal crash of a Russian M28H helicopter near Homs confirms, the Russians haven't quite gone home. And by way of an exciting further future complication, Syria's Kurds are floating a plan for an autonomous federation in Syria's north. Michael, we'll start with Russia. Do we understand yet, do you think, to what extent their announcement of their withdrawal was rather more announcement than withdrawal?
I think it was rather more announcement than withdrawal. It's been pretty clear because somebody took Palmyra, and it wasn't the Syrian army, took Palmyra back from ISIS about a week ago, 10 days ago. There was some drawdown. That's true, but it seems to have been cosmetic. And what's interesting is that there was an initial lull after the ceasefire went into effect, but it's pretty clear that it's breaking down along a wide range. And what has happened is that all sides seem to have used this period to reinforce and rearm, so that, you know, there's been some news, the al-Nusra Front, for example, lost its commander, and yet it has regained territory. Today there was a bombardment over the border into Turkey. Turkey responded with mortar fire back. So Russia can't go away quite yet because it's still pretty clear. There's a lot of confusion and there aren't enough, you know, journalists can't really cover it like a blanket, but it's still pretty clear that the Syrian army cannot hold territory. Russia still needs to clear it and hang on to it if the Assad regime is to survive.
Matthew, all that being the case, from Russia's point of view, and I do realise that trying to see things from Russia's point of view is can be an interesting exercise, why make the announcement? There has been some suggestion that there were fears in Moscow that the Russian public may start to perceive this as another Afghanistan, but Russian combat deaths, acknowledged at least Russian combat deaths, amount to six. That this is a way off crisis point, isn't it? We are not in the quagmire zone yet.
No, certainly not. And I wonder, I think you may well be right on that comparison with Afghanistan, that kind of great psychic wound in the Russian national consciousness going back to the 80s about what happens when we have foreign interventions that go badly. But it's interesting looking at that Washington Post story that we mentioned. I mean, they're saying that about a third of Russia's fixed-wing aircraft have left the country, and there's still plenty of helicopters in action
and
there.
And fixed-wing aircraft can be flown back fairly swiftly.
Exactly, within hours. And there's even been more details coming out from the Russian side about the role of special forces in selecting targets and training Syrian forces. So, yeah, this great pomp and ceremony with which the withdrawal was announced, it does seem rather premature.
Michael, I was struck by an intriguing quote, really, from Vladimir Putin last Thursday, I think, in which, discussing the withdrawal, he said, "Our active efforts in combating international terrorism have gone some way to improve our relations with the leading powers." Is it possible that Moscow sees its intervention in Syria as in some way, if not necessarily an apology, then a way of, I guess, making up for that business in the Crimea, which sort of put it on the outer a little bit.
Well, I think that in from their point of view, that was clearly part of the intention, although I do think that the primary intention was to prop up the Assad regime and to, you know, secure Russia's place at a port in the Western Mediterranean. And it is true that since engaging militarily in Syria, there's been something of a drawdown in Crimea and in I guess it's eastern Ukraine, the western edge of Russia. Depends on, again, whether you're looking at it from the Kremlin or from the White House. So I think that there may be something in that. But, you know, the dynamic that we don't, that I find interesting, and if I was the State Department correspondent for a great metropolitan newspaper, would really be delving into is, what is the actual relationship between John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister? Because pretty clearly, they have a great deal of conversation about in advance of Russia's arrival in Syria and a great deal of conversation about this so-called ceasefire, which is, as I say, crumbling away.
Matthew, let's take a look at the other aspect of the Syria story as it currently sits this week, and that's this yarn emanating from the northern reaches of Syria, that the Kurdish population in the north have set a sort of a six-month countdown for the establishment of an autonomous federation, an autonomous Kurdish federation, that is, in the north. This so far seems to have done what nobody else has managed to do, which is unite literally every other protagonist in the Syrian imbroglio, all of whom, if for different reasons, think it's a completely terrible idea. The Syrian Kurds will have seen that response coming. Why are they doing this?
Well, presumably this is their long-term agenda in the region, is to try to form some sort of contiguous homeland on the northern border of Syria and the southern flank of Turkey. But as you say, certainly the Turks will be incandescent at that prospect.
As will the Syrians and the Iraqis, the Russians, the Americans, the Iranians.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, it's not unusual to hear this kind of rhetoric coming from the Kurdish quarters in Syria. And of course, in Iraq, they have a much more established enclave as it is. But, I mean, given this, essentially the great powers are now playing the chess game, Russia and the US taking a much more active role, neither of them either would presumably want to see this development. So it does seem like it's still a lot of wishful thinking.
Because, Michael, there was a definite sense, I remember, maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, that the idea of Kurdistan had at last come. There was even quite open talk about the idea of a referendum on independence in Iraqi Kurdistan. That does seem to have faded a little bit. There's less talk about it now than there was. Why is that?
Well, because the United States doesn't want it. I mean, the Obama administration foreign policy is doing this very delicate balancing act with an increasingly authoritarian, I mean, I won't say it, as I will, dictatorial regime in Turkey that it is reliant on for both basing its own aircraft that fly over Syria and maintaining, you know, some semblance of solidity in NATO. The European Union, as always, slightly behind the big brother's coattails, needs Turkey to be solid if they're going to try to work out how to deal with the refugee problem. And if the Turks are at war with their Kurds, and there is, you know, we have to remind listeners that we talk about Syrian Kurds, we talk about Turkish Kurds, but the border between Syria and Turkey in the Kurdish region is about as far as it is from walking out this studio down to Oxford Street in London. And that's a matter of several, well, say 500 meters. And that is as far as it is. So it's one region. And they are quite closely related. And the fighters are quite closely related. So, you know, what's happened is it's gone off the front burner, because once the Kurds had done the dirty work and pushed ISIS back out of Kobane, and this goes back almost a year and a half, and pushed them back deeper into Syria, well, they weren't needed. Kurds do this from time to time. Just before I came into the studio, I was reading a press item from the Syrian Kurd representative in Washington saying The U.S. and Israel need to know who their real ally is, and it's time to get behind this. It won't happen. It just won't happen.
Okay,
right away.
Let's move seamlessly along from one perennial geostrategic headache to another. The snows are melting in Afghanistan, heralding the beginning of what the locals refer to, often entirely cheerfully, as fighting season. The Taliban indeed have taken the trouble to formally announce the commencement of their spring offensive, this year called Operation Omari, in honour of their late and largely unlamented figurehead, Mullah Omar. Matthew, Afghanistan is a country you know well. The Taliban statement said that they will employ all means at our disposal to bog the enemy down in a war of attrition that lowers the morale of the foreign invaders and their internal armed militias. That's pretty much what they've been doing all along, isn't it? It rather lacks the element of surprise at this
point.
Well,
that's right. They didn't use the phrase graveyard of empires by any chance, did they? Because that's normally
I don't think so. We did get a jihad against the aggressive and usurping infidel army.
Sounds familiar.
I did like usurping infidel army.
But and I remember sitting in the Reuters newsroom in Kabul, getting these emailed statements from time to time from some Hotmail address, presumably somewhere in Quetta in Pakistan, and they would always be quite entertaining to read. But obviously the situation itself is not quite so entertaining. I mean, we've seen the levels of civilian casualties break new records every year since the intervention started.
And various reports suggesting that they are now better armed, equipped and funded than at any point since 2001.
Exactly. So, I mean, The military situation in Afghanistan generates very little coverage and very little airtime these days. But the casualty rates that the Afghan National Security Forces are taking are absolutely horrific. I mean, I think there was something like 5,000 casualties last year. And when you think that the NATO-led force lost about 3,500 in total in the entire 13-year intervention, that's pretty staggering. And it's not sustainable either.
But is it? I just want to ask you, Matthew, because you've been there. Is it just a one-front fight for the Taliban? Because there have been reports surfacing from SO1 today, in fact, you know, saying that ISIS has kind of started moving in on their territory and might be trying to usurp them as, you know, the true bearers of jihad in Afghanistan. Is that true?
Well, there's certainly this report of an ISIS-allied faction that's emerged in the east of Afghanistan near the Pakistan border. But to what extent that is driven by an international agenda or whether it's a reflection of local power politics and the kind of factioneering that's constantly taking place in that part of the world, I'm not sure, to be honest. I'd rather suspect it's probably more reflective of the latter. And, you know, the Taliban does remain quite a unified, powerful, cohesive unit. They're certainly doves and hawks in the leadership when it comes to the prospect of negotiating some sort of peace agreement. But, you know, it's not showing any signs of going away.
Michael, there is that imperishable wisdom of guerrilla warfare that a local militia like the Taliban fighting a foreign occupier basically wins by not losing. Now, at this point, do the Taliban have on their side the fact that, well, I guess the question is, how much more blood and treasure is America and the wider West willing to spend on Afghanistan?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I follow to a small degree the politics in Kabul, which are fairly corrupt. And I think that at a certain point, there'll be a sense that the government has to get its act together. But I don't know. Because Afghanistan is a patchwork of different both sects and ethnicities, and the Talibs represent one sect, essentially. They're quite dominant in the battlefield. You know, it could be that it isn't necessary to have a lot of soldiers there. Simply, it might be better to, I don't know, reconfigure the Afghan army and empower units based on sect and ethnicity if the idea is to tie the Taliban down. Doesn't do much for national unity, if that's your long-term goal. But if your short-term goal is to just keep the Talibs tied down, they might have to go that way.
Just a final thought from you on this, Matthew. Where those two, I mean, it's about the intersection of those two dynamics, I guess, a strong, confident, resurgent Taliban and a West which is losing interest for various reasons to varying degrees. The US is due to reduce their presence from 9,800 to 5,500 troops this year. Is it actually possible that maybe not this spring, but maybe the spring after, the Taliban could walk back into Kabul?
I think that's unlikely. Certainly, though, we saw the fall of Kunduz a few months back in the north of the country, briefly, which was a huge blow to the Afghan security forces and the government. I think it's more likely that you'll see the Taliban nibbling away at the periphery, particularly in Helmand province, where the British lost so many soldiers, and particularly regaining control of the heroin and opium trafficking routes, which are obviously the lifeblood of the movement's finances. And actually, it's that political economy of the insurgency, which I think explains a great deal and is often neglected.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Michael Goldfarb and Matthew Green. Coming up next, the interesting question of where one starts when composing a Donald Trump attack ad.
All this week, tune in to Monocle 24 to hear features, interviews, new programmes and more from Milan. With the latest news from the design industry, as well as a guided tour of the best running routes in the city, Monocle 24's new show, The Rundown, will give you a head start every day during Salone del Mobile. Then get your running shoes on and put what you've heard into action by joining Nike's world-class coaches and pacers for an exclusive morning run on Tuesday and Thursday, starting at Nike's space at Via Orobia, Quindice. As well as all that, our Monocle team in Milan will also be there until the 15th of April, broadcasting live, meeting top designers and good friends, and having plenty of fun along the way. So come running with Monocle and Nike, tune in to The Rundown and join our team for the latest from Salone all week on Monocle 24.
You're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Michael Goldfarb and Matthew Green. Now, one might imagine that the composition of agitprop attacking Donald Trump would be one of the less complicated of the political operatives' challenges, requiring little more than copy-pasting Trump's public statements next to a picture of him. However, if Trump never reaches office or accomplishes nothing while in it, he will at least have created a sizable industry of anti-Trump advertising. Of the $132 million spent thus far on negative ads during this presidential campaign, slightly more than half of that fabulous sum has been spent attacking Trump like this.
He says we should punish women who have abortions.
There has to be some form of punishment.
That Mexicans who come to America are rapists.
They're rapists.
And that we should ban Muslims from coming here at all.
Total and complete shutdown.
It's wrong. And it goes against everything New York and America stand for.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
Real quotes from Donald Trump about women.
Look at that face. Would anyone vote for that?
It really doesn't matter what they write, as long as you've got a young and beautiful piece of ass. This is how Donald Trump talks about our mothers,
our sisters,
our daughters.
Marco Rubio is a recognized foreign policy expert. And Donald Trump? He praises Putin. Doesn't know what our nuclear weapons triad is. In today's world, we can't have a president who knows nothing about foreign policy.
Look, I got the Trump action figure.
No, wait, it's huge.
What does he do?
He pretends to be a Republican.
We wouldn't tolerate these values in our children. Why would we want them in a president?
The obvious retort to all of which, Michael Goldfarb, is that he still is leading the GOP race. Does that tell us something about negative ads, or does it tell us something specific and unique about Donald Trump?
Well, it tells us that these ads were probably launched way too late because his opponents, I mean, the first few that we heard were obviously Democratic ads, but the last two that we had were Republican, and it's very, very clear that nobody took him seriously until he was several hundred delegates ahead. And it's almost impossible now for any of his, the two remaining Republicans in the race for the nomination, John Kasich and Ted Cruz, to catch him. So all they can do is hope to prevent him getting a first ballot victory. So they underestimated him totally. And it's just a taste, I guess, of what one could expect if he does get that first ballot nomination. But if he doesn't acquire the, 1,237, don't quote me, but I think that's it, 1,237 delegates needed to win nomination on the first ballot, they will disintegrate, and so will Trump, and he'll become a footnote. So it's interesting. I think they needed to get on him sooner. The problem, of course, is that in some ways, because of his massive popularity initially, it was clear he was speaking the language of the Republican voting base, and they didn't want to step on their toes.
No. Well, I mean, you're quite right in that everybody thought he was a preposterous sideshow who would eventually flame out of his own accord. That's certainly what I thought all along, like most professional observers of this spectacle.
Not me.
Well, that is true, actually. You did think he had more legs than most people did. I am as bewildered as most people. I remain as bewildered as most people. But one of the things that I guess is bewildering, Matthew, I'll put this to you, is Trump having reached this point, does pointing this stuff out actually help him at least as much as it hinders him? Because his whole thing has been that he is the anti-establishment outsider. And if and when the establishment then just gangs up on him, which is what the establishment is clearly now doing, does that not just reinforce his narrative?
Well, absolutely, isn't it? It's the outrage value that has gained him so much publicity, and it's almost as if it's the Trump show, and his rival candidates are positioning themselves in relation to him. He's very much setting the agenda and the tone. But I thought what was interesting about the clips you played was the action figure that, you know, that kid saying, you know, he says he's a Republican, and I mean, certainly, again, as an outside observer, by turns fascinated, horrified, appalled, mesmerized by this contest. It's very interesting.
I'm sure there actually are Donald Trump action figures, by the way. I would be astonished. I mean, I have a Barack Obama action figure I bought in 2008, so I'm sure you can get
them for
Donald Trump.
You don't have to actually be president before you get one. Yeah. That's the question. Hopefully there won't be a Donald Trump action figure. But this divergence within the Republican Party between the traditional establishment and Trump, I think is a fascinating phenomenon to observe. I think I was reading it had been. It's almost like the sort of Republican brain versus the Republican brain stem, the kind of policy architecture versus the instincts of the base.
The medulla oblongata, yeah. The lizard brain.
The ego versus the id.
Yeah, well, precisely. You know, it's interesting. I am finally beginning to doubt that he will get that. The number, even though we'll know better after the New York primary, which is a week from tomorrow, I think. Lots of delegates at stake, and it's his home state. But you could, if Donald Trump were to be the Republican nominee, and assuming Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee, after all of the turmoil of this primary season, you would actually have two people who cannot persuade anybody new to their side. Everybody knows them, everybody has a view, and they're never meek and mild views. People either hate Hillary, or they say, she is my choice. Same with Trump. And so you could actually have an election where both candidates have massive negative ratings, and they would be fighting it out. And it would mean that whoever wins would have quite a bit of the population just full of anger about their victory.
It's unlikely to be a clean, mannerly contest played by the Marquess of Queensbury's rules, certainly. I mean, Matthew, to follow that point up, is part of the problem when attempting to attack a candidate like Donald Trump, is you can make all the obvious points that he's ignorant, that he's ill-mannered, obnoxious, xenophobic, all of those things. But isn't part of the problem that's actually why quite a lot of his supporters like
him?
Well,
quite. Exactly. That's actually the appeal. It's this kind of populism, this lowbrow reality TV style confrontational politics that's actually seems to be the kind of wave he's riding. The wave he's riding. So how you actually undermine that, I don't know.
I mean, the attack ads will keep coming, especially, Michael, if Trump is the nominee, and as you point out, if Hillary is the Democratic nominee as well. People always pretend to be appalled by attack ads, but they endure. Do you think it's one of those things that it's a bit like fighting in football games? People always profess to be appalled by that as well, but I've always rather suspected people quite enjoy it.
So long as the fighting's on the pitch. When it was on the terraces, it was really unpleasant.
I'm getting an image of that Tony Blair face. Was it the Tories?
the upside down eyes.
It's sort of devil's face that backfired.
The reason people go negative is that it works. It's that simple. And we saw it here in Britain last year. You know, who is that Australian fellow?
Lynton Crosby.
There you go. As one Australian to another. Lynton Crosby went negative. He went negative hard on Ed Miliband. And what seemed, in the polling, right up to polling day, to have been an extremely close race, actually worked. And, it certainly worked for David Cameron, because as an old Etonian, he would never dirty his hands in this way, and it works. It works in America, although, you know, there's so much money sloshing about that, in a sense, it's almost, and people know what it's like. And if you've ever been in America in a campaign, in a state that's competitive, and you're watching television, which everybody does in America, which is one of the reasons Donald Trump is so successful, and you get a commercial break, and you have 2 minutes of this relentless negative advertising, not just about, you know, running for governor and running for senator, but running for local councilman, because you have to be on TV, and there's so much money you're allowed to raise and so on. It is phenomenal that it has any effect at all, but it does, and that's why they do it.
Well, finally tonight, we've just got a couple of minutes left, we do have enthralling news from my homeland for numismatists everywhere. As the Reserve Bank of Australia unleashes a new $5 note, it looks a bit like the old one in that it's broadly purple and bears a picture of Queen Elizabeth II, but it is enlivened somewhat by a colourful stripe up the middle decorated with images of the prickly Moses wattle, which is a plant, and the Eastern Spinebill, which is a bird. Matthew, first of all, what do you think?
I feel like I'm watching television with the clarity with which you described that. I can see it in my mind's eye. I didn't think it was as bad as some of the critics suggested, actually.
And I'm obviously there have been people on the internet unhappy.
Exactly. And I also need you to explain to me what is wattle, which is a word that's been used repeatedly
wattle is it is our national flower. It is a small, puffy, yellow thing. I actually have a wattle tree in my back garden here in London. As immortalised in Monty Python's Australian Philosopher's sketch with the lines, "This here is the wattle emblem of our land. You can stick it in a bottle, you can hold it in your hand." Both of which are entirely true. Michael, what did you think? It has the Queen with the wattle, and we now know what the wattle is, and the Eastern Spinebill.
I thought... I understand why it's so busy. Busy, busy, busy. I mean, I didn't realize that that's what it was. It looked like bees going up along the middle stripe. But the controversial element is that it has a picture of Her Majesty the Queen.
Who was on the old $5 note as well.
But doesn't seem to be approaching 90 on this one. This is the picture of Dorian Gray version of the Queen.
Are you arguing in favour of Canada's slightly more brutally realistic depiction of her, I think, on Canada's $20 note?
Well, I know that some of the people who've been commenting online are staunch Republicans, and they're in the minority. I think Australian Republicans have to just accept that most of their fellow citizens rather like being close to the Queen. They're very good at basketball, and that's about as American.
But the Queen is very good at basketball.
Australians are getting better at basketball,
and I think that's
about as much Americana as they want. They don't want to be a republic. I don't know. I'm sure that counterfeiters are having a fit because it looks an impossible bill to counterfeit. But I think aesthetically, it's actually rather poor.
Well, just finally, one from each of you before you go. Matthew, first of all, do you have a particular favourite banknote? Is there one you most look forward to spending?
Well, the highest denomination, naturally, that I can get my hands on. £50, I think, will probably be about my upper limit.
I've got a 50 billion dinar Yugoslav note from the hyperinflation days. I think it's 50 billion. It's just five with, like, note zeros along the bottom. Yeah. Michael, do you have a particular favourite?
Unfortunately, I haven't had that many banknotes pass through my hands the last 10 years, so I missed the £1 note, actually. I like paper money, even in small denominations.
Well, the Australian one is, of course, plastic, as will the UK's become over the next couple of years, joining such forward-thinking nations as Papua New Guinea, Romania, Mauritius, and, of course, Canada.
That's the kind of fact you only learn on Midori House.
I know. Well, it's one of the services we provide. For now, however, Matthew Green and Michael Goldfarb, thank you very much for joining us. That is all for today's Midori House, which was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Charlie Young, and Maria Granina. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's music next, 1900 Hours, Section D with Josh Fennett and Henry Rhys Sheridan. And you can hear more on the day's big stories on the Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.